All right, well, back to the Jordan Valley here. I think an important thing to remember is that this whole area is basically in a rain shadow. The prevailing rains in the winter, of course, come in off the Mediterranean and beat against this side of the mountains. But very abruptly, when you go east of Jerusalem and down there, why, the rainfall drops off almost totally. So that, in effect, most of this valley is complete desert, except for irrigation. Now, the modern Israelis, with artesian wells, of course, have of course, started farms down here, but that's, of course, a very modern thing. Remember, this was the area where Bishop Pike died not too long ago. He made the mistake of wandering off the main road, and even worse, of leaving the shade of his car when he was lost. And of course, then he was soon lost for good. And remember, this was the whole area where David held out when he was fleeing from Saul and so on. It's ideal for guerrillas, and of course, with the Arabs against the Israelis even today, it's not good for much of anything else. Full of caves, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, if you'll recall. They were hid in the caves not far from the Dead Sea when the Romans came, apparently, and they didn't live to come back to retrieve them to modern times. But that gives you an idea of the territory. Of course, today, again, the Israelis, now since the 67 war, have built a road down the west side of the Dead Sea, but that's, of course, extremely modern. So this whole area, really all the way up, and of course, here again, there gets to be more rain as you go north and so on, it changes you there, but this is largely all desert. And of course, you've got a tremendous drop in a few miles from about 2,000 feet above level to 1,300 feet below sea level in a lateral distance of some 7 or 8 miles or so. And of course, it goes down extremely sharply. Of course, there's naturally a sign when you get to sea level on the road, inviting every tourist, of course, to stop and take a picture and the like. But nearly all desert, and of course the story of the Good Samaritan, all the rest of this territory. Jericho, of course, just north of the Dead Sea, very important from way back, was fed by a strong spring then as well as now, and for trade relations, of course, it's at a key spot. Salt, of course, it's always in demand, but was available from the Dead Sea, and a lot of salt still comes from there, particularly the southern Dead Sea, where it's shallow. There are salt pans, you know, parts are dammed off to evaporate and so on. And asphalt, sometimes it's referred to as the asphalt lake, that big blobs of asphalt float to the surface naturally. It's probably to be tied in with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Incidentally, while I think of it, we'll talk about this more next time, this new archaeological site that's been discovered north of Damascus from about 2,300 B.C. mentions Sodom and Gomorrah as actual towns that were in existence at that time with which Ebla had trade relations. Ebla is way, way north of here, northern Syria yet. And in a way, that's interesting because, you know, for liberals at least, why that was, you know, all an area of mythology or fiction or something. But anyway, well, that just comes to my mind now. Of course, Sodom and Gomorrah must have been somewhere down here. And that has something to do with how extremely shallow it is down here, this little peninsula that sticks out. There are times when it has been possible even to ford the Dead Sea down there. Usually it's a little bit too deep for that, but still quite shallow. But otherwise, then, as a result, there are, of course, no towns along this area at all. It's you know, just there, very much there, but otherwise, of course, couldn't be used for anything else. You can imagine what the Israelites confronted when they crossed the Jordan. They had this tremendous cliff to climb with, of course, the military advantage to the defenders from the heights and so on. And, of course, crossing somewhere near Jericho. And they, you know, their first battles were, of course, with Ai up in the hills here. So they must have taken, you know, some of these wadis, one of these canyons up here on the attack. Please.
Lot, when he chose in separation of Abraham, he chose the area around Jericho.
Yeah. well watered.
Just as well watered, yeah. And being very fertile area.
Mm-hmm. That must have been from the same spring, right around Jericho there. Yeah, that isn't true of the area in general.
I see.
But right around there, it's a strong spring. And even today, you know, provides not only ample drinking water for modern Jericho, but, you know, for considerable farm irrigation. Of course, as I said again today, of course, the Israelis have sunk all types of deep artesian wells, but that wasn't there, of course, in those times. Yeah, and not only Sodom and Gomorrah is mentioned in these new tablets, but the town of Zoar, which, remember, was the little town to which Lot and his daughters fled before Sodom was destroyed. That's mentioned, too, in the same context as you know, trade relations. So the whole area is mentioned there. Well, I guess there's not much more to say about the Jordan Valley. Of course, it's a very important geographical feature, but otherwise not historically of much importance. Maybe we could comment when Saul died. Remember, Saul met his death at Mount Gilboa, which is up here, by the Philistines. And you can see what the Philistines were doing. It was pretty hard to get up in the hills and then capture them, so they were just trying to surround them. They were going up here, you see. And we know that the Philistines, from other sources, that they had even, you know, gotten into the Jordan Valley. So that meant that when Saul died, why, you know, things were pretty well over, you know, humanly speaking, if David hadn't been over, been able to, by hook or by crook, quite literally, you know, to regain power, and of course eventually turn the tables completely. The site, David's place where he holed up for a long time, acting as though he were allied with the Philistines, remember, is a site called Ziklag, not too far from Hebron down here, a very spectacular site. There, overlooking one of the deep canyons that goes out to the north. But remember from there why David was able to, by his trickery or whatnot, to eventually get Hebron and, of course, then eventually the whole territory. Well, let's move on. The next zone, then, is the Transjordan Tableland. And it's called Tableland quite often. It varies a lot in territory, and in names. If we start up at the north here, below Mount Hermon, this, of course, is the area that in modern geography is the Golan Heights. And that name wasn't given to the whole territory in Bible times, but Golan was the name of a biblical city. You may recall it was one of the three cities of refuge on the east side, to which people who were, you know, unjustly accused of murder could flee temporarily. Bezer, Ramoth, and Golan were the three cities of refuge on the north side. So the Golan Heights, very fertile, referred to in the Bible more by the name of Bashan. Cows of Bashan, bulls of Bashan, you know, for grazing, they're referred to a lot, the name of that territory there, southern Syria, basically. But then moving more into Israel proper, and some of the territory, of course, that the Israelites conquered initially before they crossed the Jordan. This is the general territory of Gilead, probably wooded in those times, as I said, it still is today, relatively high. But pretty soon they lost it to the people who are known in the Bible by the name of the Ammonites, who of course play a prominent role throughout the Bible. And here's one thing that's worth commenting on, how often these biblical names are so tenacious through the centuries, no matter how many invasions and different languages and different countries, the same name sticks. One could think, of course, of some of the Indian names in our own country. Nobody, you know, knows even what they mean anymore, really, but, you know, we still have those names. They're extremely tenacious. And this is one example. Ammon is the same name as the capital of Jordan today, which is Amman. The only thing which has changed is the vowel from O to A. In fact, the name of this city, Amman, in Bible times, remember this is the city that Bathsheba's husband was fighting at in that episode, you know, when David tries to get rid of him. The biblical name of that city is simply Rabbath Ammon, the height the citadel or something like that of Ammon. And in fact, that is still is today still one of the highest parts of the modern city of Ammon, and there have been excavations up there and so on of the city that David was trying to capture. But this is in New Testament times, the city was known by the name of Philadelphia. The Romans and the Greeks came in, and of course, had to give their own names to it. And so, you know, the people, I suppose, dutifully used those names, you know, for a couple hundred years. But eventually, you know, that too passed, and then the old names came back and have stuck until modern times. There are many examples like that. Of course, it's unpredictable. Other times, of course, the biblical names disappear without a trace. And sometimes they don't even know where they were. And sometimes just the opposite. You know, of biblical names, one of the main biblical places that we just don't know where it is yet is Gath, one of the main five Philistine cities. We know it had to be down here somewhere. We know where the other four were. But Gath, it just eludes us. There are, you know, three or four good candidates with stout defenders of all of them. But, you know, just no certainty about it. It's one of the major examples like that of a city that's mentioned quite prominently in the Bible. We just have lost it somehow. Well, back to this side. As I was saying before, this side of the Jordan is cut by really some major rivers. And these two basically carry water all year round. Down here, where it isn't quite so dry, where they sometimes dry up in the summertime. I said this one before, the Yarmouk isn't mentioned in the Bible, although it's really the biggest of all of them. This one is mentioned, the Jabbok. It's one of those names that maybe isn't quite so well known, but it plays a prominent role. Genesis 32, where Jacob fights with the angel, remember, and his name is changed to Israel, takes place on the Jabbok River somewhere, you know, up in the back in the hills. In fact, the actual site we're reasonably sure of Peniel or Penuel there. The town of Sukkoth, mentioned quite a number of times, is just at the point where the Jabbok River comes out of the hills and enters the Jordan Valley. And on the whole, this is a tremendous, tremendous canyon here. And was often a boundary, although that boundary moved an awful lot. Sometimes one people controlled it, sometimes others did. But as we move down, the classical territory of Moab and the Moabites, of course, were mentioned ever and again, where Ruth came from, and so on. Its homeland was basically between about the top of the north end of the Dead Sea and this next major canyon, namely the Arnon River, A-R-N-O-N. Although sometimes when it was strong, it extended further north and sometimes even further south. But basically in this territory here. And here particularly, this is flat enough and it still gets enough rain. You see, this is high enough again that it catches the rains after they've crossed the Jordan Valley, that you have a strip of some 25, maybe 30 miles that gets enough rain for a good crop regularly. And this here is quite fertile. This is sort of the breadbasket of modern Jordan and many references to this in Bible times. So the Moabites were often quite strong. The Arnon River, and then down here basically was the territory of Edom, the Edomites. And again, the boundaries fluctuated a little with political strength, but basically this was that area. And basically going on down to, now we need another map of the Near East. Here we have a decent one. Yeah, this will do. Basically, the Edomite territory, here it is, land of Edom. From the southern end, more or less, of the Dead Sea on down to this arm of the Red Sea on the east side of Sinai. And, of course, controlling this seaport here very, very often. This map shows, of course, the Arnon River, the Jabbok, and the Yarmouk River up there. And this is largely pretty mountainous territory. Maybe we should comment about the capital of Edom, namely Petra. In the Bible, it's called Selah, which is just the Hebrew word for rock, and referred to as the rock city, and puns or plays on that name quite often in the prophets as a symbol of the pride of the Edomites from which God will haul them down. The Greek name for this is really just the Greek word for rock, namely Petra. You can see this is the same name as Peter, that means rock. And what makes this so famous is that really the only easy access to it is through a long, narrow canyon, so narrow sometimes it's really a riverbed but rarely any water in it, where some places you have to walk single file, even today. So one man could hold off an army very easily. And when you get in then there's a broad valley that was their capital and so easily defensible. And to make it even better, sort of isolated in the middle of this broad valley is another rock, you know, that just juts up out of the middle of nowhere, sort of a citadel, the only access to which was by some steps, you know, carved out of the native rock, so that this was doubly, you know, almost completely impregnable by an ancient army. And so naturally they were felt quite secure from a human standpoint. And today it's a major tourist site. If you read the tourist posters, of course, they call it the Rose Red City, half as old as time. I don't know who dreamed that one up, but sounds great. And it is worth the trip if you can get down there. You often see pictures of the soft red sandstone down there. The fronts of buildings are carved out of the stone, and then sort of a cave hollowed out is the building itself in the back, plus a lot of freestanding buildings. Well, what else do we need to say about that? The Bible mentions this, the highway that runs basically once you're out of the valley, down this whole length, is referred to as the King's Highway. And until very recent times, the modern road went along there too. Today, it's hardly what you would think of as a King's Highway, but at least historically very important. Of course, in modern times, of course, they build a road further out, where it's flatter. Of course, you can drive faster, so this one isn't used so much anymore. But historically, it was important. And well, the final zone, there isn't much to say much about. The final zone is, of course, the desert that stretches for 1,000 miles on over to the Mesopotamian valley, where, of course, there are nomads, plenty, Bedouin, and there were in biblical times, too. It's been the general history of the Near East. Whenever these kingdoms got a little bit weak, why, then they were good pickings, you know, for the Bedouin to come in and pick them off if they could. And, of course, as long as these kingdoms were at all strong, well, of course, they held the nomads at bay and made them stay out in the desert. But that constant battle, it's sometimes said, between the desert and the Solon, between the arable and the desert territory, is just one of the givens of Near Eastern history throughout the ages, going back and forth and still today a little bit. Even today, it's remarkable how the Bedouin, with their smuggling and so on, which is much of what they live by, even with helicopters and modern equipment, why, they're every bit the match for it, these human mountain goats in mountainous territories, and of course, knowing the desert whither no man can follow, like the back of their hand, why, they still maintain themselves very well. Well, I think that's about all I want to say about Palestine. Maybe we should turn now to the back side of the sheet, unless you have some questions. Or some name here that strikes your fancy that you'd like to ask about? Anything at all, please? No, let's see, I think that's usually spelled in English with an H, isn't it? I believe, yeah. And no connection, because we don't know what that means, to be frank. Anyone who will finally tell us what that means will be very famous. We don't know. You know, the usual guess is that this meant a musical interlude when the choir or the chanter stopped singing and then just the instruments played. That means some kind of an interlude or the like. But that's a guess, but that's the most common one. But no connection at all with this. Yeah. Okay, the other side then of the ancient Near East in general. And here, I don't know what happened to my good
good map.
Yeah, maybe I can sketch just a little bit of what I want to do with that. You know, the Near East, if one sketches the eastern end of the Mediterranean, here, of course, is Palestine, down here, and Syria up here. And the Euphrates River comes down, something like this, and the Tigris from over there. In this area, you have Babylon and Assyria, the two together of which we often know called Mesopotamia. A term that's often used is to talk of this, which makes sort of an arch way, as the Fertile Crescent. Maybe you've heard that name. What's really desert in between, what we've been talking about before, you know, the Dead Sea about here, this is fertile. But, and of course, this river valley is very fertile. But in between, you know, 1,000 miles of plain desert, that even today, of course, there are roads across it, but even today, you think twice before you take that trip. And prefer to do it at night because of heat, but for other reasons, you're not too eager to travel at night either. You don't go that way very much, unless you're in a convoy or something. So not basically different than it was in Bible times. So the trade routes, you know, basically followed. So the crescent here from Egypt, you know, we talked about the lower part of the trade route here. Basically then after it got into Syria, into Damascus, went up here to northern Syria and caught the Euphrates Valley. And then at least it was going that way, went there. Remember, this was the route of Abraham, basically. Apparently beginning here at Ur of the Chaldees in Babylon, and of course coming up the Euphrates to Haran, up at the top of the crescent, where of course Jacob and Laban still were, of course, later, and then of course Abraham, of course, eventually coming down this way. With Egypt, of Egypt we have a better map here. With Egypt, of course, the trade route basically hugged the Mediterranean until it picked up the Nile Valley. Especially with the Nile in antiquity as today, you really have just a very narrow ribbon of green along the Nile that can be irrigated. And as soon as the mountains rise on either side where it's not feasible to irrigate, why, of course, you have howling desert. To this day, if you visit there, you know, you can stand with one foot in some of the most fertile ground on earth, and with your other foot, you know, in ground that's been, you know, always been a complete desert. One interesting little story from ancient times that's worth noting, about the time of Moses, or maybe a little bit before, when the Egyptians were building an empire. They generally, you know, the Egyptians were quite isolated by the desert here, and they had trade relations, but pretty well, you know, this shielded them from invasions by others, and they themselves didn't cross it too much. But at that time, when the Egyptians first went out on their empire, they got as far as the Euphrates River. And the Egyptian soldiers sent a dumbfounded message back that they must have reached the end of the earth, or just about, because they had reached a river that flowed backward. And you can guess why, maybe. The only river that they really knew was the Nile, of course, that flows north. And so naturally, all rivers must flow north. When they got to the Euphrates, that flows south into the Persian Gulf down here, why, things are all backward. That must be the end of the world. But that's one of the humorous episodes from that time. Well, the rivers and mountains on here, I think we have pretty well talked about. Unless you have questions on them, Under mountains, maybe we should look at Mount Sinai, number 8. The traditional site for Mount Sinai, but we're not absolutely sure that that's it, is, of course, toward the southern end of the peninsula of Mount Sinai, the peninsula, of course, formed by these two arms of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba here. And the highest mountain, the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, is largely sand or just a rock desert. But you have quite high, massive mountains to the south. And the one of the highest of those is the traditional site of Mount Sinai. It's one of those places, if that isn't Mount Sinai, it should be. It's far and away the most spectacular site, and a great adventure to climb to the top and see the traditional site where Moses is to have received the Ten Commandments there. And, of course, the monastery, not at the foot of it, that has been there from ancient times. You know, if you go to Palestine, when you try to trace some of these sites that we're not sure of, particularly when it comes to exact locations, you can pretty regularly trace them back to about the 4th century A.D., that is, when Christianity became a legitimate religion in the Roman Empire. Particularly Constantine's wife made a trip to see all these holy sites in the Holy Land. And one suspects that tourist guides then were not too much different than they often are today. They are pretty happy to tell tourists what they want to hear. And it's very rewarding to tell the tourists that something happened here. And of course she had the money, of course. She could start a shrine or a church. And nearly all these spots, nearly all these places, you can trace them back that far. No doubt the tradition goes back that far. But unless we have other means of being sure where it was, why, you can't be sure of the back of that. And that's basically the same thing with Mount Sinai here. But it's not at all unlikely that that is the spot. But, of course, there are a lot of questions, of course, about the wilderness wanderings and the various locations of the places that are mentioned. Many of them, of course, were just oases or sometimes not even that. But it is not unlikely that that Mount Sinai was down there in the southern part of the peninsula. Yeah, please. Yes, they're just two names for the same thing. Some writers preferred one name and some the other. You know, while we talk about historical critical method, here's one of the things, you know, if you're looking for trouble, you can find it, and here's one of those things. People who want to find all kinds of contradictory sources and stories in the Bible, this is one thing they seize on, as though there were contradictory memories even of what mountain this was or where it was or so on. But, of course, that's poppycock, but that's typical of the type of thing that you often confront. Of course, most of Sinai is howling desert, wilderness. But one other major site that should be mentioned is this one, is Kadesh Barnea, that shows up here. And remember, the Israelites spent something like 38 out of the 40 years in the wilderness, more or less, in this territory. There's a strong spring there again. In fact, two of them, not far apart. And so with their flocks and everything, well, here was ample water. And it's not far from Palestine. Remember, they made an effort to invade from the south, from Kadesh Barnea, which isn't far from Beersheba. Remember, they failed because of their grumbling and for other reasons. And then eventually when they did cross, well, I remember then they went down and bypassed Edom, went down from here and went around and, of course, clashed with Moab and then eventually, of course, crossed just north of the Dead Sea. But Kadesh Barnea is a very important site. In fact, that name Kadesh in Hebrew means holy, means a holy site. And there are other Kadeshes. The Barnea is sort of, you know, like saying St. Louis, Missouri. It identifies that Kadesh in distinction from others. You had a question? Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And of course, then they followed that up with an attempt to invade, contrary to divine command, remember, and then they failed. But, you know, this is an important spot in the whole wilderness there. Well, while we're on that here, of course, the land of Goshen, where the Israelites lived in Egypt, must have been along this sort of a canal, a depression along there that was fertile. And, of course, the other sites in Egypt that I think we don't need to talk about unless you have questions here. Well, let's take a look at this. At some of these other sites, number four, perhaps, should be mentioned on the list here of cities. Ugarit. You may never have heard of this. It's never mentioned in the Bible. I want to talk about this next time. It's a little bit of a transition. This was a city that was destroyed probably before the Israelites came along, or at least before they invaded Palestine. They were destroyed by about where Ugarit is on the northern Phoenician coast, north of this map a little bit. It's up, well, off this map, but it's up just about, you know, where you get to Turkey. You see where you have to turn to the west. But it was destroyed by about the by if not the Philistines, then by you know, people who belonged to that same movement. The Philistines were invaders who came down from the north, from the Black Sea area, and destroyed, you know, everything, every country in their wake, and finally got stopped just short of Egypt down here. But the city of Ugarit was one country that they destroyed, or part of that general movement destroyed about this time. But some tablets were discovered there. Of course, it had been forgotten. It was farmed. But then in modern times, one farmer had apparently a little deeper plow than someone else, and his plow went a little bit too deep and opened up a tomb, and one thing led to another. And one of the major archaeological finds of modern times, in 1929 that was, and it still hasn't all been excavated, but all kinds of tablets have come out of there. And I'll talk about this more the next time. One of our major sources of knowledge of the history of that time, of the Canaanite religion, that we'll want to talk about in our third lecture, that, you know, we knew a little about from the Bible, but there it's mostly, you know, condemning it. And the prophets, you know, don't bother to tell us too many details. They were only too happy to say no more than they had to. And, of course, they could assume that the people they were talking to, you know, knew perfectly well what they were referring to, but we couldn't. But from this site, well, we've learned at least an awful lot more. So we'll pick this up in other times. But this site is very important. Ugarit was its ancient name. Ras Shamra is the modern Arab name for this area. We'll talk about that name next time. If you skip over to rivers and mountains again, the last one, number eight, Mount Casius. This is a mountain just a little bit inland from Ugarit. It's really just sort of the northern extension, you know, the Lebanon Mountains up here, shortly before you get to Turkey. And this is important because for the people of this area, this was sort of the mountain of the gods, something like Mount Olympus, that you may know of in Greece, at least where in their mythology they pictured, you know, all the gods as living, and various references to this in the Bible, too. So from that area, too, it's important. Well, let's move on down. Number five here, Byblos. Byblos is a seaport just north of modern Beirut. It was sort of the predecessor of modern Beirut, sort of. Is about, get my bearings here, yeah, it's just off this map, just north of there. But it was the major, it was an Egyptian colony, and their major port for getting the wood from Lebanon and so on. But one thing of interest there, if you change that Y to an I, and change the OS to an E, of course, you get what word? Bible. And that's where the word Bible comes from. Bible originally means book, book in general. And it got its name after this seaport where the Greeks, you know, first heard about such things. So it's important for that reason to us indirectly. In the Bible, Byblos is referred to the name of Gebal, not mentioned very importantly, but it is mentioned a couple of times. Number seven, Carchemish. Is of some importance. On the Fertile Crescent, Carchemish is the major city, really right at the top of the fertile. Carchemish would be about here, and Haran is just a short distance away. And today it sits right on the Turkish-Syrian border. If you visit it, well, you have to have a soldier lead you around so you don't step on mines, a very sensitive area. But it can be done if you have the right soldier. Again, you may not know that name, but it's mentioned a lot of times in the Bible. After the Assyrian Empire was destroyed, and there was a power vacuum in the Near East, why, the two main contenders to replace Assyria were Egypt and Babylon. And, of course, the people from Babylon coming up this side of the Fertile Crescent and the Egyptians coming up this side met at Carchemish, and a major showdown battle, where Egypt lost out, took place at Carchemish. And it's mentioned in the Bible. Of course, it's not one of the better-known names, but really terribly important. In 605 B.C., that was. Remember, in that connection, King Josiah, in the Bible, tried to stop the Egyptians as they were going north, and he tried to stop them at the Pass of Megiddo. Remember, he lost his life in the pass there. And then the Egyptians went on up and, in turn, lost themselves at Carchemish. That was a very traumatic thing. Remember, Josiah was a righteous king. And things never were right again in Judah after Josiah's death. But that all fits together a little. That's just one of the many times. And, of course, Megiddo played an important role in the history of this territory. Well, let's see, what else should we talk about here? Haran, Asher, number 11, is really just the name for Assyria. The city gave the name to the whole country, as very often. Nineveh, of course, was its capital. Babylon in this territory. Number 8 and number 14, I'll just mention this time, Mari and Nuzi, they're not mentioned in the Bible, but they're also sites of archaeological importance where tablets were discovered that have told us an awful lot about the background of especially the patriarchs. Many of the customs of the way the patriarchs did things, many of the stories of Abraham with Hagar and Jacob versus Laban and whatnot that we just didn't really understand fully. We can probably mention a few of them next time, have been explained by these, what we've discovered there. Tarsus, of course, is a better-known name. Of course, you know who came from there. Saul of Tarsus. Of course, Paul. Where is Tarsus? Anyone? Yeah, it would be roughly about here. But this isn't drawn to scale or anything, but it's in southern Turkey. And going the other direction from the Fertile Crescent. It's just below a major pass, of course, in the mountains of Turkey there. But right on the seacoast. Of course, that was much, much later. Antioch isn't far from there, of course. Antioch, as I said, right here was Rosh Hamer or Ugarit, and Antioch really is just inland, a short distance from that site. Was, of course, the area where Christians were first called Christians, and, of course, plays a very important role in the early history of Christianity in the book of Acts. Aswan or Elephantine, number 18, is the site where the Russians recently built the huge dam on the Nile River, which incidentally, again, has played ecological havoc with the lower Nile, as you may have read, with erosion and marine life and everything else. That's something else. But this interests us especially because there was a Jewish colony at this site about the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, probably originally mercenaries who had hired themselves out to the Egyptians to guard the Egyptian frontier down there. And some of their letters have survived and so are of much importance to us. Yes.
Several years ago, the National Geographic had quite a long article and a real fine map of this whole area.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if you wish, by all means. Sure, of course, periodically, of course, they put out maps nearly every time, but often of the Near East a lot, too.
Of the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Of course, I could have brought along, you know, there are all kinds of good Bible atlases, too, that are very valuable. Each one has its own strengths and weaknesses. For my money, I think perhaps the Westminster Atlas, published by the Westminster Publishing House, is one of the best. We've got a series of maps and a commentary on that, and, you know, there are. Thank you. Yeah, that may be of interest next time. Bring it along. Well, maybe finally, regions and peoples, our time's about up. Any comment on that yet? Assyria and Syria, remember, we always have problems with keeping them straight. Really, that was an ancient mix-up. We shouldn't feel too bad, but we've sort of inherited somebody else's goofs there. But Syria, of course, was the territory here. We should call them Aram. They were Arameans, and they spoke the Aramaic language. If we used that name, well, we wouldn't get mixed up, but we're kind of stuck with Syria. But, of course, Assyria was, of course, you know, far away over here. And, of course, Assyria was a major world power in later times that eventually gobbled up Syria and, of course, Palestine as well, where Syria was relatively small. The Arameans were the same people in that area. The Amorites were the name of the people from which probably Abraham is to be connected with. Maybe we can talk about that more next time. The Amorites lived in this general area, and they were one of these people who were never strong until the surrounding countries got weak. And when they got weak about this time, they sort of exploded in all directions and destroyed all the older kingdoms all around the Fertile Crescent. And probably Abraham's movement is to be hooked up somewhere. We still can't date Abraham exactly and fit him in exactly in the political events of that time. But it must be, you know, shortly after 2000 BC, somewhere in connection with the Amorite movements. Many of the customs and the words and so on that he used are Amorite in nature. The Hittites, number nine, the Hittites lived up in what today is Turkey. And the Hittites were destroyed by the Philistines again, or by some people of the same general movement. Philistines came, you know, from the Black Sea area up here and destroyed just everything in their wake. And as I said, eventually got stopped just short of Egypt. Egypt stopped them, but it sapped so much of Egypt's strength that Egypt itself was weakened for 300-400 years afterwards. But that meant, of course, that the Philistines, of course, were here to bug the Israelites throughout the biblical period. Well, I hope we did a little justice to geography tonight. But obviously, that's one of those topics you could spend a lot more time on. Well, next time we'll move on to archaeology and then history. History, of course, takes place on geography, so we'll presume that you remember all of these names next time and go on from there.